thank you everybody for joining us. I'm here with Dr. James Frazee, who is a doctor of clinical neuropsychology. And we're about to talk about dreams and consciousness, which is a topic I think everyone's interested in. We all have dreams. And even if you don't have dreams, it's probably just that you're not remembering them. And so we can all relate to this topic. And so I just want to dive right in. And so, James, if you're up for it, I'll ask you to just respond to the question, what is your understanding of the nature of dreams?
So I find this topic absolutely fascinating because it's mysterious in that it's something that is ubiquitous in people's experiences. Everybody dreams. And yet when you ask somebody, what is a dream? You're going to get a lot of different responses from it. When you ask different researchers, different areas of expertise, they all have a different perspective on what dreams are. And this has been true for all of recorded human history. The ancient texts of the Hebrews refer to dreams as things like messengers. And so there's this idea from as long as humans have been around that somehow a dream has a message to be delivered to you, that there's some meaning, there's an inherent meaning to dreams. Now, I teach clinicals. I teach in a psychology program. I don't teach clinical psychology. But when we cover dreams, a lot of students get very upset when I introduce them to the scientific version of it, which is the activation synthesis hypothesis, which is really at its base the idea that dreams have no meaning, right? That historical context that our ancestors gave us through tradition, and this is ubiquitous across cultures, everybody thinks dreams have meaning. But then these decade of the 90s comes around and everything's in the brain, and this activation synthesis hypothesis goes, hey, we can watch your brain while you're asleep and then wake you up and you can say, oh, I had a dream. And we'll just say, yeah, that's just random neural activity that you are trying to reinterpret in some sort of a cognitively salient narrative form. And that's all that is. It has no meaning. There's no deepness to it. And while that's the actual answer to what a dream is your attempt at reformulating random act, and it's not necessarily random, activity of your brain while going through a very procedural like sleep architecture. When we say it has no meaning, it takes away the personal connection to our world and our story. And so what I've tried to do in my teaching in general psychology is to challenge students with telling them, and this is what I want to challenge your audience with, is that you don't dream when you're asleep, that you dream when you're awake. And I don't mean lucid dreaming. I don't mean you're awake and you're creating some narrative of your own volitional mind. I mean, you don't actually dream when you're asleep. The way that we describe being asleep is somebody who is gone under a specific sleep architecture. So if I put a bunch of about 24 electrodes on your brain, not on your brain, on your scalp, and I measure the electrical impulses of the neurons underneath them, what we see is that right now you and I probably have something called beta, which is a certain amount of hertz, that's cycles per second of activity of the neurons in our brain. And it allows us to do things like language and memory and thought, critical thinking. If I was chilling, sitting on my couch, hop in bed and I'm just about to go to sleep, then my brain shifts into a slower gear and slows down that speed of the hertz. So I don't have as fast of them. And with that slowing down of the speed, my brain is capable of less in terms of complex cognitive tasks. And what happens is progressively I get slower and slower. We go through stage one or alpha and stage two, theta, and then eventually into very deep sleep, which is so deep that your neurons, which are normally firing insanely fast, you know, hundreds of times a second, will be firing less than once a second. I mean, they're literally in almost a suspended animation in this deep, deep sleep called delta. When you don't stay in that deep sleep and then come right back up into consciousness, you kind of go through these cycles throughout the night, about 45 minute to 60 minute cycles of sleep. And when researchers wake people up in the middle of one of these cycles, they tend to report different types of dreams. And then these researchers have related that to what's happening in their brains. Now, when I think of people dreaming and I think of when they dream, I think that they dream as soon as they wake up. I don't think that they dream when they're asleep because they're unconscious. The idea that your brain is awake enough or in this beta level activity that you and I are now experiencing, that's what we need for a story. We need that for a story, and you know it because if you watch TV and you fall asleep, you go alpha and then theta, and somebody wakes you up, you don't remember the story in between when you fell asleep and then when you woke up. You don't have the capability of carrying on a narrative. Although you might know this, the normal architecture of a story with the beginning, middle, and end, with the tension build up and the tension release, you don't remember what happened. So you're not aware of it. That's the idea of being unconscious. But when you wake up, you are emerging into a faster and faster sleep architecture of neurons firing, and that makes you try to sort of understand it, and yet you don't. You try to understand it as though it was an awake experience where what just happened to you wasn't a sleep one. And I relate this to people's problems with remembering things that happened in traumatic situations. Like if we look at eyewitness testimony, Elizabeth Loftus's work over how people remember the details surrounding things that are very emotionally upsetting, people do a terrible job of remembering those details. In fact, they interject things to kind of make the narrative story make sense. Right. And so my perspective on dreaming, what I share with my students is, you don't dream when you're asleep. You create a dream narrative once you've awoken. And this is something that is extremely upsetting to my students. I mean, I say all sorts of controversial things in my general psychology class, in my statistics class, in my human sexuality class, in my biopsych class, but nothing riles their feathers as much as when I tell them they're not dreaming when they're asleep.
So is your perspective that, because let me, and the first thing I think of is, what about those dreams that seem to be going on for a long time? So would you say that even a seemingly long drawn out dream occurs all within the brief moments of waking up? And then it just kind of, as you remember it, it has a different, you have a different perception of how long it was lasting?
That's actually a difficulty with my theory on dreams, is that we have a paradoxical relationship with sleep and time. One is that if you fall asleep and you go into one of those 45 to 60 minute sleep cycles, if you go all the way down to the deep delta, and then you basically, what happens is you reemerge into stage two or theta, and then you'll go into REM or this fast acting paradoxical sleep. If you go through one of those cycles, you're not going to remember the last 5 minutes of what happened when you went to sleep. You'll have a retrograde amnesia for it. Yet what's really amazing is that people don't understand this about sleep, but they don't need alarm clocks. If you set your iWatch or your iPhone to wake you up in the morning, oftentimes people will recognize that they wake up 2 to 3 minutes before their alarm goes off. And that's only if they've had sufficient sleep. So maybe not my college students who aren't getting sufficient sleep, but people in their young adult years, when you start to have to sleep enough to have energy during the day, you'll notice that you wake up before your alarm goes off. And the reason you do that is we have a mechanism for timing sleep and when we wake up. It has more to do with the PER and TIM, which are chemicals in our brain that sort of beget sleep. They prepare your brain for sleep, and the buildup of those over the day, and then they ebb off as you go to sleep. And so that when you wake up, they're at their lowest level. That has to do with a cyclical timing. But the time of when dreams occur cannot possibly be when you're asleep, because you don't have conscious awareness to have a story happening. And even if you did, you couldn't know it because you can't respond. If you can respond to stimulus, you are conscious. That's how we use the distinction between people who are conscious and unconscious, is that they can distinguish stimuli. Mm-hmm. So the question that's interesting is, why do we think we dream when we're asleep?
Do you have an answer to that?
I don't know. I mean, Maybe we were told that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So some researchers at Boston University have studied this and found that if you wake up during REM sleep, you're more likely to have activation of certain areas of your brain that are associated with fear, and you'll report more negatively affective content. Whereas if you wake up in the non-REM sleep, that's that stages two and the slow wave, the theta and delta, then you report more positive content to your dreams.
Hmm.
And they relate that to what parts of your brain are active. I relate it to if you're in very fast acting activity, that's more anxiety provoking. But if you're in theta, you're in just this totally relaxed state. And it's almost like the anxious valence of emotions versus a calm valence. And so that's what I would relate it to. But all these people, all these researchers have different ideas about it. And the reality is you can never answer this question. It's going to remain a mystery, because if you were conscious, you wouldn't be dreaming. You would be just thinking of a narrative. And if you're unconscious, we can't really tell what's happening to you then.
Right. Understood. Then that leads me to the next question. Where does lucid dreaming fit into this? And I think that just to clarify, I imagine most people listening know what that is, but just to be crystal clear, this is when you become aware you're dreaming while you're dreaming. And most people who have this experience report that they have the freedom to really create within the dream, create the scenery, create the storyline. So, and you can modify if you have a different understanding of that, but also, yeah, if that makes sense, then how does this fit in?
So lucid dreaming is, again, as you've described it almost perfectly, as I understand it, is this experience of becoming aware, right? And so that is literally what we say becoming conscious, is to be aware of one's environment. And if you're conscious, then you're not in an unconscious state. And when we don't dream when we're unconscious, or we couldn't know if we do, I consider all dreams lucid dreams.
Hmm.
What the difference would be here is really the control factor, what you've described, which is if you realize that you are in control of the narrative that you're creating, then you might want to direct it in a way that's more positive. So if we go to people who are less biologically inclined and talk about dreams, we could talk about Freud and Jung, and their perspectives on dreams were that they were aiming to fix something that was going on with your ego or the self, right? That something was missing. And so for Freud, it was these unfulfilled wishes, and you become this champion in your dreams, right? And you get the unrequited desires. For Jung, it was a little bit different. It was that it hid in symbols things that were missing from you and that you actually needed to pursue. Now, both of those guys are kind of aiming at, it's uncovering what's an unconscious thing for us that moves us towards something good. And so in a lucid sense, it might be, in a lucid dreaming sense, lucid dreaming might be wonderful to help people with their overall emotional stability and well-being and thriving, because they can take those narratives and move them towards areas that are going to help them have a concept of self that is well established, that is promoting the types of character that they want to display and the behavioral patterns they want to display. If somebody's overwhelmed with dreams, and most of the people that are overwhelmed with dreams tend to be children, those are the ones who have the night terrors. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that have the nightmares. What we see is that they are mostly terrified because they are experiencing something that is not understood. And when you have people who are doing lucid dreaming, they have an awareness of it. And so that awareness drives away the fear of not understanding something. If you want to practice lucid dreaming, people have taught others how to begin doing it. And really it starts with being open, right? This is a personality characteristic of open to new experiences, right? And this is not something that all people come to as easily as everyone else. So if you're not as open to new experiences as a personality, it might be more difficult for you to try this. But if you try it, it might happen. It might work for you, and it might be beneficial. So I'm a big proponent of trying it, and if it works, keep doing it. And if you try it and it doesn't work, stop doing it. Do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as lucid dreaming is concerned, you are not unconscious. if you are aware.
Right. So would you say that, if your point is we can't say that we dream while we sleep because sleep is an inherently unconscious state, but dreaming is a conscious state, then that's why we can't say that we dream during sleep. Have I understood you?
That's exactly my point. The researchers that I was describing, Dr. McNamara at Boston University, they have to wake the patients up during these different stages of sleep to see if they have different affective responses to the different stages of sleep. But no, they wake them up. So those patients are no longer in an unconscious setting. They are made aware. They're like, hey, wake up, Derek, Susie, wake up. They wake them up and then they go, what were you dreaming? Right? There's a protocol to elicit from them these dreams. And while I can appreciate the facade of science there, there are some questions that science are not well suited to answer. And that's why I think it's really important in this sense that we're able to sort of bring in our humanity's oral traditions. And we're able to bring in even our discipline, psychology, and their early people like Freud and Jung, who are thinking about the effectiveness of dreams on revealing unconscious things that people are suppressing and that are keeping them from thriving. I think it's one of the areas that is actually meant for unity amongst people. It's enough of a mystery that it enables us to investigate something together that we all go, yeah, we don't know what this is.
Right.
But for all time, people have thought dreams are really important. You know, whether it's a prospective analysis, you think that this dream, you know, like biblical dreams, right, where Joseph dreams of the famines of Egypt, right? Well, that would require action.
Mm-hmm.
That would require big action. And if you go with those actions, then good things will happen for you. And if you don't go with those actions, then bad things would happen for you. Now, I'm not saying that dreams are that. But I am saying that people have acted as though dreams are that.
Right.
And those beliefs are basically rules for actions. So how do we sequence our behaviors is through our belief system. And I think that one of the ways that people are divergent now is the traditionalists and the progressivists. They could be unified by saying, hey, we don't know about dreams, but they seem to be important for people. Let's sort of get together on this and spitball things, throw things around. And that's why I present my hugely unpopular and yet unassailable logical assertion that you don't dream when you're asleep.
Right.
It feels very uncomfortable for people to take on that thought.
Yeah.
And yet nobody has offered a counter yet. Mm-hmm. And so if there are people in your audience who are able to think through this better than I am, I would be very interested to know about it, because it enables us all to sort of get a better understanding on what dreams are and what is their relevance to humans.
Interesting. Because I think what people experience when they recall a dream, based on your line of thinking, may be the initial experience of that flow of mental imagery. But for some reason, it has a quality of being remembered in that moment. Because if what you're saying is true, then we would have to account for this sense that I'm remembering something that already happened or that I already experienced internally. But I do think it's possible that when a person wakes and the images of the dream are very forefront in their mind, it's possible that those images have manifested for the first time in that moment. But for some reason, which is hard to understand, there's this sense that this is the replay of what I just experienced while I was sleeping. I also wonder what you think about a few things here coming to mind. But one is those experiences, like I bet many people can relate. I know that if I am snoozing my alarm over and over, I dream a lot. And so do you think it's possible that people are coming in and out of consciousness, and that it's actually when they're coming into consciousness that they're experiencing these images we call dreams?
Right. So it's not a binary sense. You're not either unconscious or conscious. There, it's a gradation, and we know that because we can literally watch the slowing of these neurons. What we do know is about, like, if you're at stage one, alpha, you're in this relaxed state. You're not doing deep thinking, but you're open to thinking. If you're in stage two, which is characterized by these K complexes and sleep spindles that we see on the EEG architecture, then I would need to wake you up. You would not be aware of anything, right? So there's a distinction between being aware of anything, even at a little bit, and not being aware. If you're in stage two sleep, and I'm seeing the very, very distinctive architecture of that sleep, I'll need to wake you up. Now, your experience of that is, if I woke you up in stage two sleep, most people report, yeah, I was asleep, but I just fell asleep. So their sense of it is, the sense of that timing, and it doesn't matter, it could be 2 minutes in stage two sleep, or it could be 20 minutes. You're not going to spend 20 minutes in stage two sleep, but aside the point, however long you spend in stage two sleep, you don't have a sense that it was, that time passed. Time is now sort of that magical thing that happens when we go to sleep. When we wake up, it feels like that.
Right.
That occurs at stage two sleep. So I would argue for stage two sleep to be this real line of distinction in the sand between awakeness and not awakeness. What we see in sleep architecture through the night, if you go that full 8 hours that we're all supposed to get, none of us do, but we're all supposed to, then you'll see the patterns changing across the night to really promote early in the night that deep sleep that makes you feel rested. But then later in the night, we have far more dominance of REM sleep. Mm-hmm. And REM sleep is typically reported as that if you wake somebody up during REM sleep, you're watching their EEG, you've got that sort of look, and you can see that the architecture of this, so they call it REM because it's rapid eye movement. But really what's going on is that the brain is sending a paralysis to the body. And why they name it rapid eye movement is that only the third cranial nerve, which is your oculomotor nerve, is above the area that gets paralyzed. Because your brain's going to go through this revving the engine. Think of an engine and a clutch. You got to push the clutch in if you're going to rev that engine. Otherwise, if it's engaged, the car's going to go. Similarly, your body is going to go if that engine gets revved at night. And so to keep us from flailing and doing crazy stuff at night, your brain paralyzes your body. And that's a very deep, deep paralysis. But if you get woken up from that, it has the potential for all sorts of weird things. Like many people have experienced what's called sleep paralysis. And they wake up and they go, I'm awake, but I'm not sure if I can move. Now, they're not moving. They're just thinking this in their head, right? They're not moving their arms, because if they can move their arms, they know they can move. Mm-hmm. But they have this sense of, I don't know if I can move. And really, that's probably them waking up into a conscious state, into that alpha and beta level, before the brain in REM has shut down its paralysis of your skeletal muscles. And that can make people make up stories. And the stories that we hear typically are that sometimes they feel like something's on their chest. They feel pinned down or oppressed. The particularly religious will often describe encounters with demonic beings in this time. Mm-hmm. People that aren't will say aliens, but they all kind of come up with the same stories. And really what's happening is they're trying to explain something that we already do have a physical scientific explanation as to why they're experiencing that. And that is, during REM sleep, your brain has to paralyze your body.
The only, I guess, challenge that's come into my mind toward your framework of dreaming as being while we're conscious is there are the cases when a person is experiencing an emotional and physiological response prior to waking. And the most dramatic, perhaps, example is that of a wet dream, and a person literally, I'm kind of assuming, I haven't watched someone, under an EEG experience a wet dream, but most people report that they wake up to that physiological response, that is exactly what wakes them up. So what would you say to this? How does this fit into your theory?
Right. And that's a great contention. The way I would consider it within the framework that I've expressed is what's happened is a physiological response. Again, this is ponticular. Ejaculation in a male is is a ponticular response. That's low brain. That's not the higher brain that's doing the storytelling. But when we have nocturnal emission or a wet dream, then this is something that happens most often in young men, in men that aren't in a consistent sexual relationship with somebody. When people get into a consistent sexual relationship, wet dreams go away. So this has to do with their bodies learning to do something from a physiological standpoint, and they need a narrative. And we culturally, and this is another topic maybe we can talk about because it's dear to my heart, is that we don't do a very good job of accepting the fact of sexual development of our young children. And we also don't support them at all during that. We support them in all sorts of other areas of development, and we almost abandon them in sexual development. But in this sense, what a wet dream is really a reflexive response to hormonal instigation of, hey, we're getting this system ready because this is a very important reproductive system. And we've got to try it out, right? We've got to test it, so to speak. And what the brain does is says, I want to make sure that this reflexive activity works. And I can do it during the night when it hasn't been accomplished through stimulation during the day. But when you wake up, you go, why did that happen? Why did that happen? And you begin to create narratives and stories. And if you ask people to describe the contents of their wet dreams, oftentimes you'll find people that go, oh, I'm not telling you what I was thinking about, because mm-hmm. that was some crazy shit. Mm-hmm. That was some wild stuff that I don't want anybody to think is a part of me. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that is also difficult for people to recognize, is that whatever dream, whether I'm wrong or I'm right, the perspective is that dreams are you, that everything in the dream is you. You know, if I dream of my wife in my dream, that's not my wife. That's my projection of the person who is my wife. It's not the actual wife that I have. Mm-hmm. And I say this, and I use my wife as a reference, because she wakes up sometimes super mad at me. But I didn't do it. I didn't do it, any of those things. But her affect is as though I did. Her anger or disappointment or rage at me is there initially, because she hasn't separated the narrative from what's happened at night to what's happened in reality. And so we feel, right? We feel these dreams, whether it be in a sexual sense, like a nocturnal emission, or you're mad at your spouse for something they did in your dream. When you wake up, you still have the real physiological arousal, right? You're still getting that sort of sympathetic nervous system arousal. And so when you create the story of my husband wasn't doing the right thing, or I was in a sexual encounter, right? These sort of ideas are the narratives that then express to us a connection between why we were having that physiological arousal level. And then it creates a cohesive story. And we like that. We don't like the tension of not knowing why we're feeling a certain way.
Okay. That fits. Yeah. It's kind of the, you know, some people describe it as the James Lange theory of emotions, that the physiological response actually precedes the narrative and the mental imagery that comes along with it. Okay. Well, to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and maybe just to lay it out there like this, it's absolutely right. Like you said, that some people believe that dreams are inherently meaningful, and that, you know, the Carl Jung view that they come in the form of symbols, which are essentially coming to promote wholeness in the psyche or in the individual. So some people believe they're inherently meaningful. Some people believe they're inherently meaningless. And then there's also the view that it is valuable to think about and interpret dreams. And it's possible that a person could think they are inherently meaningful, which would of course lead to the belief that they are valuable to interpret. But if for the people who think they're just random firings of neurons and that there's no inherent meaning, some of them still do believe that it's valuable to interpret dreams and think about them because it promotes personal reflection. And then of course there's the people who are just altogether dismissive of them and don't see any value in interpreting them. And I know I can share for myself that I've been part of dream analysis groups, and in the group setting is where I find dream analysis to be most beneficial, because other people are just projecting their own mind onto the dream imagery, which can actually lead to realizations that I might not have come to on my own about what the dream means to me. So I can say up front that I actually do consider dreams to be inherently meaningful, and I consider them valuable to interpret. Now, I also admit that it's hard to know whether they are inherently meaningful. It's like, where are they coming from? And if you have the psychoanalytic view that they're coming from an unconscious realm of the psyche, and that the unconscious mind is essentially directing these dreams, that would give us a storyline for how they could be inherently meaningful, because the question would become like, what is imbuing them with meaning? So that is, you know, I acknowledge that it's mysterious whether they're inherently meaningful or kind of random, but I definitely believe that there's value to interpreting them. And so before I ask about how we can interpret dreams most productively for people who want to, I do want to pose the question to you, given how you understand dreams, do you consider them to be inherently meaningful?
So I wear many hats. I'm a father. I'm a husband, most importantly, a father, second most importantly. I'm a neighbor. I'm a professor. I'm a son. I'm all sorts of things. And in many of those different places, I have different feelings about things. When I wear my professor hat, I have to say what is objectively observable. And that's one of these reasons why I bring up this contentious idea. I'm not saying this is. I'm saying this seems as though it is. Let's compete that idea with what with other things. So when I wear my professor hat, I would say it is the activation synthesis hypothesis that we're attempting to create. You know, and humans are amazing pattern, adaptive pattern seers. And we can see patterns in amazingly complex systems. It's a specifically, a uniquely human thing. So it doesn't actually surprise me that we try to unwind the chaotic activation synthesis of our brain activity into a story form. Mm-hmm. As a person, as somebody who's experienced analysis, and I did years of it, I think we were talking a little bit before we started recording that I was required to do it as a part of my clinical training, and I kept doing it. And the reason I kept doing it was so incredibly interpersonally beneficial to me. And I saw a therapist who had training in Jungian therapy. And then in a graduate seminar, I pursued also going and doing a dream retreat, which was a week away at one of the California missions. It was a silent retreat too. So we were to be silent during the week. And that was by far the most effective practice at inducing dream, was to not do this. If you want to dream, shut your mouth. And then we were to keep dream journals. And then we went through the process of looking at the dream analysis seminar by Jung that was given at a retreat he did. And we used that as the textbook to sort of uncover the process of Jungian dream analysis. And it served as a graduate seminar you could do for a one unit thing. So it was like, it wasn't very much, but it was really interpersonally extremely beneficial to me. You know, I'm pursuing neuropsych and brain surgery and all this sort of stuff, where I'm in hospitals and dealing with people having seizures and like very concrete brain-body relationships. But from an interpersonal point, the dreams 100% have meaning to me. What they mean, I don't know. But I believe they have meaning. I don't think that they should tell me, you know, if I have a dream of becoming a farmer on the Oklahoma savannah, you know, I should take my family from here and move there and do that as a result. You know, I don't think that that's really it. Mm-hmm. But I think that I know that they're beneficial for instigating thought. And I know that critically thinking about ideas, especially about your behavioral patterns, is something that's beneficial to people. Mm-hmm. So as a person, I don't think I don't dismiss dreams at all. Mm. Now, as a father, I often tell my sons to dismiss their dreams. And I make mental note of them, right? They're growing and developing. And if I see that the dream, that thought pattern could get in a way from them attempting something boldly, right? If it's going to get them to hesitate, get them towards an anxiety-provoked state, I'm going to dismiss it even if I think it has importance because, you know, I'm helping them to develop that competency to face those unknowns, to slay those dream dragons. Mm-hmm. And I want to build up for them a sense of their vulnerability as a person, but also to learn from the errors that they make. And if they get too anxious to do so because of some sort of thought pattern that's maladaptive, I don't want that to happen for them. Mm-hmm. So I'm on all sides of this debate. Mm-hmm. I really am. I'm on all sides of it. Experientially, very important to me. I mean, I had some crazy archetypal dreams during very transformative portions of my life. And it was as though they were just calling out to me to do something different. And once I did the different thing that was very valuable and beneficial to me, those stopped being a part of my dreams. Mm-hmm. So there's that experiential side, and I don't want anyone to think like I'm being dismissive of dreams, because interpersonally, I find them very valuable.
Right.
As a scientist, I contend that we only dream when we're awake. And storytelling when we're awake is still a beneficial thing. Mm-hmm. Getting into, if you think about things people do, finding meaning, right? That's an extremely important human behavior. And so if you're going to sit there and say storytelling is unimportant, go tell that to, you know, Tolkien or J.K. Rowling, right? These people who've created these fantastical narratives, dreamlike narratives, heroes' adventures that are really important to people, and people find personal connectedness to those stories. So I'm not dismissive of dreams. I am contentious of when physiologically this is happening.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes perfect sense. And one of the things you mentioned a couple different ways reminds me of, so I had a dream analysis teacher by the name of Jeremy Taylor. So I'll just mention his name to put it on people's radars if they're particularly interested in the psychology of dreams and dream analysis techniques. And so one of his principles about dreams was that there's a tendency to mistake them for being literal, and that mistaken literalism is something to really watch out for. So that, you know, like when you said that everything in the dream is essentially some type of reflection or projection of your own self. So when you see your lover in the dream, it's not your lover in the dream. They're not actually doing anything to you. So that's one example of not taking things literally, but rather taking them symbolically always. Or like you said, if you have a dream where you see yourself, you know, working in some other place, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's a premonition or a sign that you need to do literally that thing. So perhaps you could offer your suggestions and I can offer a couple for just what has worked, whether it's personally or what you've observed in others, what has worked to really glean the most value, insight, and meaning out of dreams. I know that I can say that interpreting them in terms of symbols of yourself is extremely helpful. And the question to ask for any character or image in the dream could be, what does this person represent to me? Or what does this person represent about me? And that could just lead a person down a whole train of thoughts that eventually could lead to insight. So that's pretty simple one. It's almost cliche, but it's worth noting just that mindset of what does this represent to me? Considering every image in the dream as a symbol of something that is a part of myself, and then asking the question, what does this represent to me? What does this mean to me? not in a literal sense, but in a symbolic sense. I think that's a great way to start interpreting dreams. What would you say for someone who really wants to experiment with dream analysis? What are some helpful strategies?
So for me, I came from a religious tradition that was only studying particular stories related to the Christian culture. And what really became a fascinating experience and enlightening study for me was to study cross-cultural experiences, mystical experiences, because what Jung's point was is that there's a commonality of humanness and human experience, that by virtue of being human, you're going to have access to certain experiences, and that the way our psyche is constructed is that there is a connectedness of that to the world, and it will be represented in certain ways. And there's much to be learned from people in cultures that are dissimilar from ours. So be open to the stories and the symbols of other cultures. And you're like, well, I wasn't raised in that culture, so that symbol doesn't mean that to me. Mm. Be very careful. You have, I'm fascinated by human brains. Human brains are the most complex thing we know of other than the known universe. And so to think, because you don't know that culture, you don't know the relationship of that symbol to the meaning that culture has for that symbol, it's ignorant. Just look at people's experiences of having had that happen again and again and again. So look to cross-cultural stories, mystical representations of symbols, because it's going to, even if I'm completely wrong about the sort of big T truth of that, it's going to create a system for you to juxtapose these ideas and then weigh them in the balance. And that'll give you a greater sense of whatever cultural value you have on that symbol. So I really like the increasing my ability to interpret the symbols in my dreams through finding other people's similar interpretations to their dream. So those were really helpful for me. Mm. And then another one is, and this is, I know this sounds super practical, I sound like a scientist, blah, blah, blah. You don't sleep enough. You don't sleep enough. Whoever you are out there, you have a pandemic, a literal pandemic of sleep deprivation. And that will rob you of sleep. A couple other things that rob you of dreams are the use of drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. So what happens is we tend to feel like we dream more when we get that REM sleep. If you take drugs, like say an Ambien, what it does is it forces you into that theta sleep. And it holds you there like a strong-armed man holding you asleep. And it gets you asleep. And for people that actually need that, sometimes that's okay. But if you rely on that, what you're going to miss out on are that deep delta that makes you feel rested and the REM sleep, which is the ones that really have these dreams most often reported after people wake up during REM sleep. Mm-hmm. If you are overweight and have sleep apnea, same thing, it will hold you in theta. You won't get to go to the deep REM or the deep deltas and those REMs. And lastly, the one that's problematic for most people, more than being overweight and have sleep apnea or taking Ambien, is that a lot of people self-medicate with a nightcap. They take some alcohol before bedtime. Sounds great, right? Especially if you're going to bed, you guys have a glass of wine, this could be fun. And that can be, but it does change, again, your sleep architecture. So this is a physiological thing you can do to get more from your dreams, is to get good, sufficient physiological rest. And when you wake up, you'll be more rested and you'll be more energetic. And what I would suggest you do as a result of having more energy and being more energetic is that you start a dream journal and that you write them down. Those, one of the things we know is that the farther you go away from waking up, the less you remember or feel that you remember what happened when you were dreaming. So if you write it down immediately, then you get a great record of it and you can refer back to that later. So those are some suggestions I have for people and their dreaming.
Excellent. Yeah, and I would emphasize the dream journaling. I know that I don't currently keep one, and that for me, when I look back, it's been only in phases of my life where I've kept a dream journal, and it does take effort, and you might have to wake up a little early than usual if you're going to be writing down your dreams, but it can definitely be worthwhile, especially if you have any intuition that it's worthwhile. And what's super helpful is, number one, they increase my recall, or maybe as you would put it, my dream experiencing significantly, just by being so engaged with them and having such a strong intention to really remember the details. And also, it gives you somewhat of a diary to look back upon for some healthy self-analysis. And I remember a distinct observation I had of my own dreams was that there was this theme of the presence of people who have died in my life, loved ones who have lost. And I never really recognized that theme until I kept a dream journal and was able to look back upon it. And it's like, okay, wow, there's my uncle, there's my other uncle, there's my mom, there's all these people that I love so much who have died and just keep reappearing in my dreams. And I simply was not aware that it was a theme. And it actually was very important for my grief process to realize that and to process the images of the dream. So I'm aware of the time, but I do want to revisit one topic that I feel I need a little bit more clarity on, just in terms of how you fit it in to your theory of dreaming. Sure. And that's the topic of lucid dreaming. So tell me again, when a person has this experience where they feel conscious during the dream, how do you make sense of that and still say that they are actually awake physically while they're having a lucid dream?
Sure, I can do it right now. One of my classic archetypal dreams, the recurring dreams as a child, was of one being on an upstairs flight of stairs and then floating, not walking, but floating down to a deep, dark area of the basement / first floor that I was unfamiliar with. Now, at the time as a child, that would feel very scary to me. And my dad said, hey, you know, whenever you have, if this is a recurring dream, you could just change the story. When you know that it's happening again, just change the story at the end. Like, what do you want to happen at the end? And so I needed to do that work while I was awake before I went to sleep, such that it was ready. Mm-hmm. And the work that I did was that there was a new thing that I found, which was a new entertainment system. You know, I was a kid, so I liked entertainment systems. That became the thing that I was going to, when I encountered this stimulus, utilize this particular behavioral pattern to address it. And when it happened and I realized that dream was happening again, or as I now would suggest, I woke up and that same interpretation of the narrative for my previous active brain had happened, I interjected this next step, which was there was this entertainment system there. It wasn't something unknown and scary. It was this thing that was desired. Very Freudian of me to do that. You know, my dad had suggested that when he had a dream, he would have dreams of things chasing him. That was his scary dreams. And so when he began to take hold of his own dreams, he'd say, well, then I would say, I'm going to take control of that thing, which is, again, very Jungian to slay the dragon. but he would take control over it in his lucid dreaming. And I think what this really represents is, regardless of if you have the ability to do lucid dreaming and feel in that sort of what we might describe as alpha level relaxation, meditative, still semi asleep, I could get to there. I'm not willing to go full bore. You're actually asleep, but I could get to the point where you're definitely in a lower level of consciousness. The problem that I have with that in lucid dreaming is that you don't have the type of fine tuned control you would want with the narrative. Is if I was, say, making up a story now, where I'm like thinking about, okay, what do I want next? What's the next thing I want? What's the thing that I'm needing to develop for myself to become more whole? That needs a lot of active brain cells to do that. Otherwise, you can get diverted and lack focus very quickly. So that's why I think lucid dreaming is probably best done in a meditative state, recognizing that you're completing the story, that you're focusing your energies, that you're moving yourself towards this meaning that you are developing for yourself. Whether it needs to happen when you're asleep or not, I'm open. I don't need it to happen when you're asleep for it to be an effective and useful thing for people. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people might want it to be more than it is. And so they ascribe magical features to it of lucid dreaming is happening. This is some sort of external connection to some other source. And while I don't discount those possibilities, we can't really make something that's repeatable for somebody else in a divine individual spiritual sense. So that's not our job. And if it works for you, that's totally fine. And if it does, you know, if you want to teach people what you do or how you practice it, I find that to be also beneficial. But suspecting that it would work for everybody, I'm a little skeptical on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think I understand. And so is it an accurate summary to say that the difference between a regular dream and a lucid dream, in your view, is that they're both occurring essentially immediately upon waking, but in a lucid dream, you become aware of that interpretation as it's happening in a way. Well, because, okay, as I try to re-explain it, it's interesting because if I'm awake and I'm dreaming, I am conscious of that mental imagery. But the difference is that I don't feel like I have any volition in the matter. And I don't feel like if I'm experiencing the dream from that first person perspective, I don't feel like I am aware that I'm in the dream. And so it just feels like I'm awake and conscious, recalling the imagery of myself in the first person going through something that I didn't know I was going through. Whereas in a lucid dream, it's the same first person perspective, but I'm aware I'm going through it in real time. And my sense, but I think, you know, you would disagree with this, my sense is that I wake up and I remember the experience that I had of the lucid dream, where I was in a first person perspective, knowing what I was doing in the dream realm.
But you, so, you're suggesting you have volitional capability of doing something in that dream realm, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, so I would interpret that two ways. If that's your experience, either A, you interpreted whatever you did as your volition, and then you didn't actually have sort of efficacy within the realm of the dream, or B, it was you continued a dream to add in a control aspect that's a very helpful and ego-syntonic interpretation of this chaotic mess that was, you know, your dream. I am not sure, but those are two things that jump out to me as possibilities of, you know, I think of deja vu, right? People have this experience. I've had this experience where I show up somewhere and I go, wow, I feel like I've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
And our brain is unbelievably good at not remembering. It's unbelievably good at forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And when it forgets that it's forgotten, you have this experience of deja vu. When you misinterpret where an experience is coming from, whether it's coming from a long-term storage and retrieved, or whether it's coming from this sort of sensory memory into our working memory, if you mix up where you think that's coming from, then you have this experience of deja vu. And you either were there or you were not there before. Mm-hmm. That either did happen to you or it did not happen to you before. And I think a really easy interpretation is that this didn't happen to you before, that you had a brain fart and you misinterpreted long-term retrieval as working memory coming from sensory experiences. That's my thought. That's an easy thought.
Sure.
But an even more complex, even more interesting one is, what about this experience from your previous experiences elicited that hiccup? Mm-hmm. Because something about this is important to you. And similarly, when I think of lucid dreaming, whether or not you're asleep and have volitional control, or you are interjecting a narrative of volitional control, this is important to you. And so that's a lot of times when people hear me be contentious about stuff, they don't understand that I'm not at all diminishing your experience. This is important to you, and I know it's important. I know it's important to me, even personally, dreaming is. But as far as lucid dreaming goes, I don't experience that. I experience it as waking up and thinking through a better outcome than the one that was happening. A lot of people have this experience where they have dreams of falling, right? And I can show you another example of how this leads towards my theory, leads towards my suggestion. We have something called a myoclonic jerk. And that again is related to the paralysis that's experienced in our bodies from the below the pons, inferior to the pons being paralyzed during REM sleep. When you're super tired, you didn't get enough sleep the couple nights before, and you go to bed, you'll almost immediately jump into REM sleep. And during that, if you go instead of that slow down to delta and then fast rise up to the REM sleep, if you go right into REM sleep, your body has to paralyze you quickly. And so people experience that as this myoclonic jerk, right? That's a commonplace thing that people are even embarrassed by it when they're falling asleep. Their entire body, mm-hmm. It's not all your muscles, but the large skeletal muscles all have a big simultaneous clonus. And what people interpret that as that they were having a dream while they were falling, and that's when they hit the ground. But nobody's ever fallen out of a really high place and hit the ground and survived. Actually, there is a Polish stewardess who fell from like 30,000 feet. Her plane exploded in Poland, and she landed, and she survived. She has the Guinness World Record for the longest free fall without. But she landed and broke like nearly all of her bones in her body and lived a horribly in pain life and like wished she had died. You know, it was like a terrible, terrible experience. And so all of us interpret this as, oh, that's that big jerk like to land. And we're misinterpreting what it would feel like to land. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to say, well, that's what I think it would be like. And that's that misinterpretation of a real experience for the fantastical version of it in our heads.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay.
I have a really embarrassing one too. I don't have that myoclonus. I don't do that. When I am falling asleep really fast, only one muscle in my body has that spasm, and it's my diaphragm. So if I'm like falling asleep really fast, I go, I make this horrible, horrible sound that's very embarrassing. And so not everybody's the same, right? I don't have myoclonic jerks. I just have this one weird thing that happens to me when I'm falling asleep. And it's very embarrassing if you do that nearby anyone. You will not live that down.
That's funny. Well, okay, you've given me a lot to think about, and I think, you know, you'll have to work on me and convince me a little bit more, because I'm still wrapping my mind around these ideas. It's the first I'm hearing of them, but I'm definitely open to this possibility, you know. So thank you so much, James.
I've enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise.
And we'll have to do it again sometime.
I love that. So
all right.
Yeah, I'll be in touch. But for now, thank you for your time. Everything you've shared has been like very thought provoking and interesting. So much appreciated. Your students are lucky to have you as a professor.
Yeah. If they want, they can see all of my videos on YouTube. Search James Frizzy, and not all of them. All my human sexuality ones are hidden because I don't want that out in public.
Right.
You want to learn statistics? That's free to you. Go ahead.
Beautiful. I'll put your link to your YouTube page in our description here.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. We'll be in touch. We'll talk again.